Nice to see you all back for our last session. I hope you had a nice lunch and you're all feeling quite relaxed, maybe not too sleepy. So if we can just gently maybe step into this kind of settling the mind business just quickly. Let your mind hover around the motivation that you had this morning. Just touch your mind again on that. The strong feeling, this is what I want to achieve, this. Just holding that as your object of concentration for a little while, not long. So we're going to start this session by a group discussion. We didn't have time to do that this morning. The question, as you probably will be able to see, is around, it's to, really to do with the equanimity, And the question will be posted, but it's like this. When you're being equitable with others, what behaviors do you eliminate? And what behaviors do you enact? And how do you know you're being successful? So when you're interacting with others equitably, what behaviors do you eliminate? What behaviors do you adopt? And how do you know that you're being successful? Okay, just plain ordinary questions. Peace and joy, 15 minutes. Thank you, Faye. Okay, welcome back. So you were having a short discussion on equanimity. Yes. So you were asked to discuss what behaviors you would have to eliminate. I don't know why I'm on screen again. Hold on. Yeah. And what behaviors you would adopt in order to behave equitable. And how would you know you were being successful? Okay. So the discussion is what is important, but it would be nice to feedback a little so that we can help each other out. So who would like to feedback a little? Jenny?
So Sherry and I were after a discussion about delights of Land of Joy and retreat. we were talking about... Well, there are a few things. So we were talking about noticing that with the friend, when we were that the people that we view as friend, whether it's just because they're people that sort of say nice things to us or about us. So just noticing when that happens. And also the whole thing about shifting the emphasis to others rather than sort of ourselves and our own sort of reactions and to things, noticing, doing our best to pay attention more to people, not interrupt. And I think we just talked about, you know, how do we know? We both were saying, well, it's like a general openness and an openness to people.
So okay.
Those were some of the things anyway.
No, more than reasonable. There's a wide array. It's quite hard to be wrong with this question, really. Thank you. Anyone else? Miguel?
Yes, we had a good discussion. I think one thing I was reminded about that came up at the end was Jiddu Krishnamurti. He once said, you know, the problem with relations is that he talks about love and then he says, I form an image about you and you form an image about me. And then all we relate to are these images that we have kind of solidified inside ourselves. there's a lot.
Same with every relationship. Yeah.
So there is something about freshness, forgiveness, seeing beyond the immediate reaction behavior that is a constant challenge or effort I have to make to look deeper into people's behavior. And that means that I have to first turn off my own anger, judgment, and all those kind of things to actually be able to sit in a state of mind where I can actually allow myself to try to love the other person enough to see behind their behavior and try to understand them from where they come from, and realizing that they're just suffering like me. I just don't like their way of dealing with it, but they also have, and remembering what we discussed also was that remembering again and again that they do have that Buddha nature, they do have that loving kindness somewhere in there, and there are reasons why they can't express it. And part of the reasons why they came up in my life is probably because I created that. So
well, now we come on to karma and things. Yeah.
So those were some of the issues we touched upon. So.
And what's coming from that, the first two groups there, is really about becoming other-centered, not self-centered, other-centered, you know. And if that's your basis, that's excellent.
But I also think, there is an element of being, I wouldn't say self-centered, but well-centered, that I have to embrace and love my own faults and enough to allow myself also to change, to allow myself to step into a new relation with that person. If I can't do it in reality, start with it in my mind, and then hopefully it will manifest someday.
Yes. And this is wise self-centeredness. This is wise self-cherishing. We talk about the negativity of a self-cherishing attitude, and that's, of course, it's true. Everything goes back to that. But it doesn't mean you don't cherish yourself. It just means you cherish yourself wisely. And how you cherish yourself wisely is by cherishing others. But you do examine yourself for sure. And if you don't start with really with cherishing yourself and your attributes, then whatever you give to others is inauthentic. And people are not stupid. They pick it up very quickly. I always start with this from the point of people are actually quite clever, you know, that people are. I've come across very few stupid people. People are very clever, and they'll pick up inauthenticness like that. They may not show it, but they'll remember for sure, for sure. Thank you, Mikhail. Anyone else? Yes, Stella.
We had a bit of a wide-ranging discussion about. I started talking about meeting with people who have dementia.
All right.
And the experience of going to see a person who I've never met before, who has dementia, absolutely not knowing at all what is going to happen in that meeting. And so, because people can be in all sorts of different stages of dementia, and you never know when you go and meet someone, you never actually know where they're going to be. Sort of joining them in their world, because they are often in another world, and being with them where they are.
Are you seeing that as a form of equanimity, being able to step into their shoes?
Sort of, not entirely stepping into shoes, because I'm not sure.
Seeing the world from their point of view.
Yeah, well, but not just not kind of not thinking, not getting caught up in what is happening, but actually allowing the person to be who they are without making any kind of judgment or on that person or myself, you know, because sometimes I actually don't know what to say. And I sometimes don't know what to do. And so it, there's a space in which I have to just be with that person and understand who they are, and also accept what is going on for me in that space too, something like that.
Okay. I mean, that's more than reasonable. I'm trying to link it to the, I could see where the equanimity comes in. And I can see how it would alter your behavior in a positive way. And you're saying the type of hate behavior you wouldn't demonstrate. So that, that ticks the criteria. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. There's a wide array of answers to this. Thank you, Stella. Anyone else? Yes, Maria.
Yes. Hello, Venerable Mary. We were all saying that equanimity is very difficult for us. We all like it as an idea, but in practice, it's very difficult. But how would we be? We would say less judgmental and wishing well to everybody, even if they have annoyed us. And I'm not the same kind of person as we self are. We don't. But just wish them well. But one thing we struggled with is, could you love everybody like your own family? But
well, I think when you're building up equanimity, I think there's a few things you have to do, really. You have to understand that the type of equanimity that we're talking about really is the immeasurable. When you're dealing with others, it's a measurable equanimity. Immeasurable. And that means you need to know what that means, how that encompasses all sentient beings without exception, without exception. Now, if you're trying to do that without exception, there's certain things you have to do. And that means you take the people that you really love around you, your family and your and when we say we love them, you know, this is not a Buddhist definition of love. This is a sticky human definition of love. Right, which has craving in it, which has attachment in it, which has being easily hurt in it. You know, no one can push your buttons like a family member or a close friend. So you're really looking, not just, oh, I love everybody. Oh, well, that's very nice. No, no. You've got to look at the people you do love and just start reducing the attachment, start reducing the craving, start reducing the hostility when things go wrong. Because you know how quickly your best friend could become your worst enemy. In one sentence, they can do it. Right? So it's about reducing that sticky attachment, that sentiment. It doesn't mean love them less. It means bring less to the table. Leave your craving, leave your attachment, leave your potential hostility. Leave that. Don't bring that to the table anymore. What are you left with? Immeasurable compassion. And that's the basis that you then extend to others. You don't want to extend the sticky craving, attachment, potential hostility, love of all your friends and family. You don't want to spread that to all sentient beings, right? But the one thing that does tell you is that you're capable. You demonstrate you're capable of ordinary compassion, ordinary loving kindness, ordinary equitable. Now take it a step further. Now take it a step further. Really look at what you bring to the table in this sticky. Yes? Get that right. So reduce the attachment, reduce the potential hostility, reduce the craving. And you're not losing love. You're not losing equanimity. You're not losing compassion. You're leaving the rest behind. Then you're left with something that you can deal with. And that's what you spread. Don't spread sticky love to everybody. That just makes the problem worse. But I understand. But it really is about reducing. People say, oh, you're asking me to reduce loving my family. No, I'm saying love your family, but with less of the less of the stickiness, the craving, the attachment, leave that behind. Then see what's left. And then that's pure love, to be honest. That's pure compassion. Not great compassion, but pure compassion, right? Ordinary compassion, right? Now, to be equitable, that's what you spread to all sentient beings. You're welcome. Whoever said this was easy, right? Thank you very much, Mia. Ali?
What came to my mind during this week was that when you say, you know, when we're in meditation and things are coming up, whether it's, you know, the Buddha entering the room or, you know, I'm picturing myself murdering a worm or whatever, you know, hideous and lovely, and we're training in this not grasping, not distraction, which is feels like equanimity in a way, if that's right.
Yes, it is. You see, you have equanimity in relation to the ordinary aggregates, feeling, form, this type of thing. And that type of equanimity is really looking at what you like, what you dislike, and what's neutral. That's okay, but that's not the equanimity we're talking about.
So how is it different? Because if you train in that, can you not then apply that to the outside world?
You can, of course. Of course. Yes, you can apply what you learned. You can apply everything to the outside world.
So how does it different from the inner training?
Because it isn't to do with feeling, the aggregate of feeling. The aggregate of feeling is basically positive, negative, or neutral. That's it, right? I like this, I don't like that, and I don't care about the rest. Not really that. Not really that. What you're looking here, if you're looking at equanimity within shamatha, you are looking exactly as you say, you're looking for a balanced mental state with no dullness, no agitation, because then that can be applied within the four immeasurables. Actually, you can do it the other way around as well, but you apply it in the four immeasurables. So now you're looking for an equanimity that really recognizes the sufferings of all sentient beings with the same feeling from all of that. Plus you want each and every sentient being to feel equitable towards everybody else. It's not just you giving the great I am. You're wishing for something more than that. You really are looking. And really you're delving in now to the area of great compassion. This is the mind that wants to free all sentient beings from suffering, all of them. It's not doing anything about it yet. It's going from ordinary compassion to great compassion. And this is the real mind that wants, you know, wants no one to suffer at all. Wants everybody to be happy. It's such a strong wish. And this is this goes hand in hand with the immeasurable equanimity. You're looking at here two things. You're looking at an even-heartedness and a balance of mind. This is the even-heartedness and balance of mind. Developing a kind of impartiality. But this impartiality is not to be cold, distant, aloof. This is the impartiality that says, I will not love this person more than this person, and I won't ignore the vast majority of the 7 billion people on this planet. That's what it's saying. And I will attend to that without distraction, without grasping. See, almost everything in Buddhism I've ever learned, the context is important. Context is everything. Right. So you look at it in the context of the aggregates and you say to yourself, is that the compassion I'm talking about? Is that the equanimity? No, not really. So is it the equanimity that you develop for a cool mental state? Yes. Is it about even-heartedness? Yes. Immeasurable. But what we do is we take our ordinary understanding of, let's say, love. If I was to ask everyone to write two sentences on love, you know, it would be all over the place, all over the place. And it would be mixed in with sentiment, with emotion, with a kind of I love you if you love me type thing. It's very sticky. But you look at the Dharma, and the Dharma's definition of love is really wanting everyone to be happy. It's clean, clear. It's not sticky. And that's your basis, not the other thing. If I was to ask everybody to write a sentence or two on compassion, it would all be different, but it would be mixed in very much with emotion, very much with very sticky. Because, of course, there's people that you want to be compassionate to, but there's others who don't deserve your compassion. It's all that type of thing. It's being compassionate towards someone and then not even saying thank you. It's that type. It comes with so many strings. No. The compassion you start with in Dharma is not wanting others to suffer. That's it. It's clean. It's very clean. And it takes you out of the center. And right in the middle of all of it are others. This is the beginning of even thinking about bodhicitta. Equanimity is very, very much. And when you're interacting with others and you're trying to develop this type of equanimity, what you're looking at, you could be, is really beginning with your understanding of Lam Rim, beginning to take responsibility for your own conduct. Taking responsibility for your own actions. Not blaming external. I don't like you because you're this, that, and the next thing. I like you because of this, that, and the next thing. Do you see? Not like that. So understanding how you make, you, I alone make my own enemies. I alone make my own friends. I alone kind of ignore the 7 billion people, more or less. That's the basis. And in, when we're doing this, what we can't do, and it does happen, you know, I mean, a few times you're being equitable, you're being compassionate, you're being loving, and maybe someone says something like, well, you know, for the benefit of all sentient beings, maybe you should leave that alone. Sometimes equanimity comes across as being cold. It can come across as being aloof. And that's a big problem. It's not that. It really isn't that. It's really about having that equitable, warm, compassionate heart towards all sentient beings without exception. All you're doing is you're doing that, and what you've left behind is your grasping, your attachment, your aversion. That's all. But sometimes people leave that behind and they leave behind warm-heartedness. Can't do that. Yeah. So equanimity, we need to understand that very carefully, because when you start studying and meditating on bodhicitta, it doesn't matter what group of teachings you study, whether it's sevenfold cause and effect, whether it's equalizing and exchanging self with others, whichever structure you're following, all of them start with equanimity. If you don't have equanimity, everything else falls. The great Lama Tsongkhapa said, and they don't mix words. There's never a word wasted here. And the order, the great Lama Tsongkhapa said, on the ground of equanimity, pour the water of love. Plant the seed of compassion. And from that, the crop of bodhicitta arises. This is not being flowery. It's telling you step by step what to do. So it's worth spending time on equanimity and getting that, you know, reasonably right. None of us get it right in practice, but at least we understand what we're getting wrong. That's sometimes the only step forward I can see, but, you know, in myself. So also less crave. How do you know you're successful? Well, you've got less craving and attachment towards those you like. You've got less aversion towards those you don't like. That's a sign of success. And generally speaking, a reduction in craving, hostility, and detachment is also a good sign that you have success. If you're having real difficulty here, not with difficulty with understanding, you know, the different levels or anything like that, but difficulties with equanimity, then compassion is your antidote. Compassion is your antidote. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Tahila.
So I always have the structure of my talk. I feel like we understand what to do, and the difficult part is how to do it, and or like when actually an event happens, can we really maintain that balance, in our treatment? But I think what's really helpful for me personally is to cultivate awareness. When the thought arises or any emotions that comes in my body or in my thoughts, if I can just detect it first, then I get some space between that and the action. And so I think a long time ago I listened to the audio of the Holiness Dalai Lama and the Paul Ekman talking about what's that book? It's called Emotional Awareness.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no one better than Paul Ekman, really, on that side. There's no one better than His Holiness. So that's a good combination. Yeah, yeah.
So on that book, he said, I listened to the audio on my long drive between Seattle and Vancouver. But the point was that he said that any emotion that comes up, there's always a few seconds before that. I mean, it's always building up to some point that we have to act. So the Holiness said that if we can just detect when it's coming up, then you have better control when the peak comes. And so
meditation, that's what you teach. You're teaching that gap to be bigger and bigger so you have choice. Yes.
Yeah, that's just what I thought, that what we do, the teaching on awareness of awareness is really, really helpful in that aspect.
Perfect for that. Yeah. That's very good. The other way is the bodhicitta approach. And if you can get into the habit, is every time you meet someone, and it doesn't matter who it is, your first thought, how can I be of benefit? It's very helpful. How can I be of benefit? That's what I was taught many years ago. And I thought, you can't do that, but you can. You can. Sometimes how you can be of benefit is actually walking away. Sometimes you can be of benefit simply by agreeing with that person and giving them a bit of space. It's not as if, what can I do for you? You know, what can I give you? How can I, you know, impart my wonderful knowledge of the Dharma to you? You know, it's not often like that. Sometimes being of benefit is often, or it can be, especially in difficult situations, is absenting yourself from the situation. If you say, how can I be of benefit, and you mean it, it may be you have now a wide array of choices and you have intelligence, so you can choose one that's reasonable. And it may be just to absent yourself. And sometimes it may be just be quiet. How many times have we been in a situation and later you thought, why did I open my mouth? I only made it worse. Not just me then, right? Okay. Like that. So sometimes you're of benefit by just being quiet. Sometimes you can give. And there's four types of giving, of course, not just one type of giving. So all of this, this is why it's very good to learn the Lam Rim. Really be on top of the Lam Rim. It has everything in it. It's fantastic, Lam Rim. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, the healer. That's more than good. Thank you, people. And any last content? Are we okay? Mikael?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I completely agree with what you said, and I just wanted to say that I feel like one of the biggest gifts of shamatha and these kind of Buddhist meditation that I have gathered from them is that even though it's just a glimpse, you know, this understanding of dependent arising and emptiness also teaches me that what I am now and what everybody else is now is relative. But if the Buddha is right and we live for eons of times, all these sentient beings are potentially the one that I love the most.
Yes.
Because I love them all, in the mm-hmm. sense that at some point I start to realize that everyone is my family. It's not just a figure of imagination. It's not just an intellectual exercise. It's the people that I inhabit the universe with. And if my existence and my happiness is dependent upon all that is dependent arising, then everyone I encounter, everyone I meet is part of that existence and are dear to me. So it's, I can't do this all the time in my own life, of course. I get
a peek, you know,
but the thought, the more I really try to plant that seed, and it seems to help a little bit, you know, little by little. But,
that does help a lot of people. For me, it was a teaching that I had way back in the 70s. Because when I heard about all sentient beings, I thought, these people are mad. You know, what are they talking about? You can't possibly love all sentient beings without exception. What on earth are they talking about? You know? How could you? And of course, I like to be practical. I'm not that clever, but I am practical. I'm saying, well, how do I do that then? And, you know, I don't meet all these people. Even though I see them on television, it's only a fraction. How do you develop this for all sentient beings? And the teaching, it wasn't just for me personally, it was for the group, because many people felt like that. And if you've had teachings from me before on bodhicitta, you'll have heard this before, that everyone you meet, every animal you meet, every insect, you see them as all sentient beings.
Yeah, I was thinking about, if you meet a stranger in the street and you figure, that person might be my next mother or father.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I've got to be nice to them, because some of us are difficult parents, you know, in this life, and that might be because we treated them poorly in other lives. Who knows?
Well, this is the sevenfold cause and effect, of course, emphasizes that very fact. But if you're out and about and it's been raining and there's lots of worms out and snails and things like that, you actually start to walk more carefully and make sure you don't stop. And whatever you come across, whoever you come across, what other sentient being, at that moment, they are all sentient beings. And I think it didn't make sense to everybody on the course I was on, but it made perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to me. And in that way, that's how it becomes doable. If things seem too airy-fairy, I can't be doing with it. I really can't. But that makes it easier. Thank you. Thank you for that discussion. That's brilliant. I'd like to use this next part to answer, or try to answer, questions, general questions. And I did have a question about when to practice shamatha, if you're doing a daily practice. Is that what people are interested in? Yeah, some people sent me. Okay. So I can only tell you, I can only tell you the question I asked and the answer I got. Because part of my practice is highest yoga tantra. And when you're doing a long shamatha retreat, then certainly in the teachings that I've been reading, is you want to reduce the ritual a little bit, you know. So, people always have a daily practice. So when you're on a long shamatha retreat, sometimes the advice that's given is that you do the shortest form of that. So when I asked Alan, he said exactly the same to me. Here is the answer His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave me. If you're doing highest yoga tantra retreat, in your sadhana, not retreat, but sadhana, in your sadhana, there is a point where you go through a kind of death process and you re-emerge as the deity. You re-emerge out of emptiness as the deity. And as you re-emerge from that emptiness as the deity, you normally have a mantra commitment to do then. Once you finish the mantra commitment, that's the perfect space within your sadhana to do shamatha. Now, if you're doing a sadhana that's not highest yoga tantra, then it may be better to do it, to do your shamatha practice after your refuge in bodhicitta. Once you've taken refuge, once you've done bodhicitta, that's a very good place. If you're doing a sadhana where you're not doing the full death process, where you're not dissolving into emptiness, where you're not arising as the deity with your mandala, where you're not doing your mantra commitment, if that's not part of your sadhana, then the best place to do it is after your refuge and after your bodhicitta. Perfect place. And then you can then, once you've come out of the shamatha, you then finish your sadhana. But like everything else, this is the advice I was given. I would always, with tantra, I don't teach tantra, I don't give advice on tantra, but I can tell you what I was told. And as Lama Alan said, this is what I was told by His Holiness. So I had a lot of confidence. That sense seemed reasonable to me. Because if you're doing highest yoga tantra and you go through the death process and then you re-emerge slowly into the deity, then you're emerging out of emptiness. Well, what is that? Really, you're trying to touch at least the conventional nature of mind. So you do your mantra commitment, you let that go, straight into shamatha. Whether it's shamatha on the breath, whether it's mind and contents, or whether it's awareness of awareness, whatever it is, you do it then. When you finish your shamatha, then you continue with the rest of the sadhana. Like I say, it's always worth checking with your own, with your own teacher. But that's exactly the advice I was given. And I took special note and made notes because it was the one thing I was worried about. Because I was planning to go on a long retreat and I've got a fair bit of commitments and I wanted to know how to make it as short as possible so I could spend more time on the shamatha. So along with other advice, that was very helpful. Mm-hmm. Any questions about that? Yes, Rowena.
So in that space, of whether it's high yoga, can you hear me okay?
No, I can, yeah.
So in that space, whether it's highest yoga tantra or non-highest yoga tantra, when you're doing the shamatha, would you do it for 24 minutes?
As long as you want.
Okay.
But remember, this is advice that was given to me because I was going into long retreat.
Sure.
Right? So because I knew I'd be doing this for a year, I wanted to be absolutely sure. Now, if you're doing it on a daily practice, still that's a good place to do it. But you may choose to do it after the refuge in bodhicitta. That's very good as well. Or you may decide, if you don't have a lot of commitments, then you do it as a separate practice. Yeah. Yeah, separate practice. You're welcome. You're welcome. Anyone else? Oh, yes, Sherry?
On that, in terms of doing it within daily practice, in terms of doing like alternating between analytical and shamatha, is it better to do like, I don't know, alternating days or like a whole week of one and then a week of the other? Or what's the best way to kind of progress with that?
I don't think there's a straightforward answer to that. If, like I say, if you're going in retreat, then shamatha has to be front and center. There's no way you develop past stage three unless you're in retreat. And unless you're focusing, 24/7 on shamatha. It doesn't mean to say you don't do all the rest of the commitments, of course. But if you're wise, you'll get advice on how to do it in an abbreviated way. So there would be in retreat, there would be no, do I do this, do I do that? No, front and center is your shamatha. Everything else is periphery. Now you can do it within your main deity practice for sure. But in everyday life, if you're just trying to build up to stage one, stage two, and stage two is you start, I don't know about you, but you start to see the difference at stage two. It's a fantastic stage to be at. You kind of know you're going somewhere, you know, it's really nice. So how you decide to do that, up to you, but it still needs continuity of practice. It's still, so it depends what your daily practice is. It really depends. But putting time aside every day to do shamatha, it benefits everything. It'll benefit your analytical meditation. It benefits everything. Your ability to concentrate will enrich every aspect of meditation, every aspect of the Lam Rim, every aspect of Tantra. It just does. So you have to work out, you know. If you've got a daily practice which includes an awful lot of analytical, okay, maybe you put a certain amount of time behind, aside, to actually just focus on shamatha. Or, which I think is the best way, and it's not often thought, but once you do analytical meditation, it shouldn't stop with the analysis. If you're doing an analytical meditation, let's say on what, compassion? Let's say, right? Analytical. So what's analytical doing? It's moving your mind from, analytical meditation moves the mind. It moves the mind from a poor understanding of something, yes? And step by step, taking you to a point where you have a good understanding, a good feeling about that, yes? That's what analysis does. It takes you from ignorance to wisdom, really. That's what it does. Now, once you get to that good feeling, that good idea, oh, yeah, compassion, it is about not wanting others to suffer. At the end of your analysis, you let that feeling go very strong. Then you let it go. And you stay with that feeling, that single point of concentration. That should always be the tag end of your analysis, always. Even if it's just for 30 seconds. Never understood doing an analytical meditation and leaving it. You do analytical meditation, and when you get to where you want to be, hold it. Hold it. But if you're developing shamatha on a particular object, then you need to make a decision, really. You know? But doing a little bit each day, that I'm just remembering what Lama Allen said. He very rarely puts time on things, but he does say if you do a little bit in the morning and a little bit in the afternoon, you might get to stage one with stage two in sight. But if you give it more than that, you've got a good chance of achieving stage two. If you put even more effort in during the day, you've got a chance of stage three. But really, a good stage three and onwards really needs retreat. It needs single point of concentration. It needs doing that, very little else. And you're looking at building up to 10, 12 and more hours a day. The minimum would be 10 hours. When Lama Allen came to see me on my year's retreat halfway through, I was quite happy, you see, because of course I'm not nature's meditator, right, I have to say. So I'd built up to about 10 hours a day. I thought this was really good. So when Lama Allen said, how long are you? I said, oh, I'm doing at least 10 hours. He went, oh, is that all? I thought, oh, no. Oh, no. So I had to kind of up it. Yeah, not easy. So depends what goal you want. You know that old adage, you know, it's essential for you to meditate at least half an hour a day. Unless you're very busy, then you need an hour. It's like that. It's like that. I've got that on my fridge, just in case I get lazy. It's a pig sitting in meditation posture. It's essential, the pig says, for you to do half an hour meditation every day. Unless you're really busy, then you need an hour. Yeah. Thank you. Anything else? Anne? Oh, sorry. Anne?
Is that okay? I'm just interested, if you you are achieving very long periods of concentration, as you did on your retreat.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say that. I did my best.
No. But the point being, you obviously need to maintain that once you come out of a retreat. Do you sort of slip back in the amount of time you can do? Or
you can't. Yeah.
It needs maintenance, doesn't it?
It does need maintenance. It does. But what's interesting is if you give it that maintenance, and by maintenance, I mean, you know, not half an hour a day, you know, doing regular longer retreats, then what happens is you gain back what you achieved during your retreat and it becomes steadier. But you can lose it for sure. Mm. Mm. It comes down. You don't lose it completely, but it will fall. It makes sense.
So it's the same with us then. So whatever we're doing here, we need to drip feed it all the time to maintain it, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And if you can do intermittent retreats, that's even better.
Are you going to talk to us about retreats?
I am. Very.
Thank you.
Depending on the time, yes. Okay, I think we need to stop it. Sorry, Tahila, was one more thing? And Mikhail, okay. Okay.
It's a very quick question related to what Anja said. Is there a point of no return? Like, you achieve it and that's it. It doesn't regret.
What His Holiness the Dalai Lama says is that once you achieve shamatha, it's very hard to lose it. You can lose it. You can. If you don't maintain it, but it doesn't take much to maintain. In this lifetime, if you achieve shamatha, the chances are very strong that you'll keep it for the rest of your life, as long as you keep maintaining it. But is it possible to lose it? Yes, but it's not easy. You'd have to really go off the rails. Yeah. Because remember, what you've achieved is not just the concentration, but a temporary suppression of the five obscurations. If you allow those five obscurations to gain foothold in your mind again, then of course you won't have shamatha. Now, that's not easy to actually let them go up then, but you could see someone deciding to go on a hedonistic, you know, craving attachment. Then, yeah, you can use it. But His Holiness says it'd be hard to lose it, but you can. Sorry, Mikhail, quickly.
Sorry, I had a question about the daily practice, but it can wait. Just go on, it's fine.
Okay, I'm just a thing about that. So, what I want to talk about here is the achievement of shamatha. You know, how do you know? You know, how do you know? Now, this is in Alan's book, you can read it, but just to quickly go through it. What he emphasizes that people first notice is a kind of sense of heaviness and a numbness at the top of the head. And that comes on quickly, this heaviness, that numbness at the top of the head. And really that what that does is it signals a kind of freedom from mental dysfunction. It signals mental pliancy, that you've achieved mental pliancy, mental fitness. And that tends to be, it's so heavy that it can actually knock people off their feet and they have to go and sit down for a bit. You know, this is one of the first things that you notice. Yeah. And this, once that happens, this mental pliancy, because the mind flows through the body on energy winds, it starts to give you physical pliancy. So you start to notice this huge physical pliancy coursing through the body. Once you have this, whatever you choose to focus on, whether it's your object or not your object, you will be able to sustain it for as long as you wish. For as long as you wish. On any object. When the physical pliancy, from the mental pliancy to the physical pliancy, when that courses through your body, the next thing they say is this kind of bliss arising. It arises throughout the whole body. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary degree of bliss, they tell you, in the body and in the mind. Absolutely extraordinary. If you have physical dysfunction, now I'm not talking about, you know, amputation or You know, but if you have a kind of gentle physical dysfunction, that is so much better, almost disappears. People who have never been able to sit in a full Vajra posture now can sit in a full Vajra posture. Do you understand? The pliancy is amazing. That's what they say. Amazing. That's the achievement. That's the achievement. You can go into a whole load of other things, but that's the main thing. This heaviness, numbness, and almost knocks you off your feet. You're kind of, what on earth's going on? And this coursing through your body of this mental pliancy, leading to complete physical pliancy. You're thinking, what on earth's going on here? In the slipstream of that, this bliss in your body and mind. And whatever you choose to focus on now, it doesn't matter what object, you're able to hold that for as long as you wish. For as long as you wish. And so, of course, you'll be able to penetrate the nature of what you see. There's other things, but those are the main things. Those are the main things. Now, I want to talk about retreat. Before I do that, you're going to go into separate rooms for 10 minutes. Faye has decided into group A and group B. If you are group A, if you're told you're group A, you need to really look at what you would have to put in place in order to undertake a two-day shamatha retreat. If you're group A, what would you personally have to put in place in order to have a two-day shamatha retreat? Group B, what would you have to put in place if your aim was to do a 3 to 6 month shamatha retreat? So if you're group A, you're going to focus on 2 days. If you're group B, what would you have to do to make sure that you would be okay for 3 to 6 months? So you've only got 10 minutes, okay? Well, welcome back. You're quite right. When you think you've got too much time, and then when you're given less, you're thinking, what does she expect me to do in 10 minutes? You know. So let's see what you can do in 10 minutes. So group A, you were asked to look at, just say you had 2 days. Most people say they've no time for retreat. But the problem is they do have time for retreat, but they don't know how to do it. They don't know how to put everything in place. So if you knew, group A, that you had 2 days next month, that you were definitely going to do 2 days and focus completely on shamatha, what would you put in place? What type of things would you put in place? What did you come up with? No, being silent is not an option, group A. Don't make me point the finger. I will. If it's necessary, I will point this finger.
I was going to nominate Stella.
Oh, were you? Right, fair enough, Stella. Yeah, if you keep quiet, someone's going to do it. How did you get on, Stella? What did you decide?
We talked about... We talked about preparing ourselves before the retreat, so making sure that people knew that we weren't going to be available, making sure that if we were working, all our work was kind of finished and up to date, putting things like out of office and messages on the phone, or even switching the phone off, not having TV or radio or any distractions like that happening, making sure that you knew what you were going to eat and the food was there and it wasn't complicated, making sure that the house was clean and tidy so it wasn't a distraction. I mean, that's if you're at home.
I'm assuming you're at home.
Right, yeah. And we were just about to talk about mental preparation. And I was going to say that I remember going to the Buddhist Center to do a retreat quite a long time ago now, and somebody at the center said to me, "Are you prepared?" And I thought, what do I need to be prepared for? And I started the retreat, and within about 2 or 3 days, I couldn't focus on my meditation because I kept falling asleep and I was really tired. And I broke the retreat to talk to my teacher. And he actually told me I didn't eat properly.
All right.
I understood then the question about being prepared. So I try to make sure now that I'm healthy, you know, that I'm not too tired, I'm not really stressed, those kinds of things.
Okay. And that would personally help you, yes, in preparation?
Yes, definitely.
Excellent. Is there anything else from Group A you would add to that?
We also talked, Stella had also mentioned about having some sort of a schedule, and we had a discussion about a schedule, and that was fine as long as it wasn't something to beat yourself up with. Hmm. And you also mentioned the thing about what texts, or, you know, if there was a text or a book or, you know, something like that you might want. I think that was it.
Okay. Anyone else want to add to that? Mikhail?
Yes, I would add something that you said earlier, and I've encountered that in other traditions as well, which is to set up a specific space to do the meditation. Mm-hmm. Like, I always sit here with my altar behind me, so it becomes kind of my sacred place. So I know that when I sit here, my mind and my body kind of connects to that. Mm-hmm. Of that, this is
an excellent point.
Different.
If you're at home, if you're lucky enough to have a meditation room, how wonderful. If you don't, then definitely identify, as Mikhail says, an area of that. When you walk into that area, that's your meditation area. As soon as you walk into that area, it's meditation. You don't use it for anything else, because it really will help you if you have a designated area, definitely. Thank you, Mikhail. Anything else you would add to that if you were preparing for a 2-day? So you've got social planning, you've got personal planning, dealing with relatives, friends, things like this. You've got environmental planning. What do you think, what are you going to allow into your house at that time? Are you going to have a mobile phone for emergencies? I should think so, but only for emergencies, right? TV, newspapers, can you manage that without that for 2 days? Some people find very difficult. There are books you will want to read. Isn't there? There are books you will want to read, but you always narrow it down to something that's definitely related to what you're doing. Psychological preparation for sure. But don't worry for 2 days. For 2 days, you can do it, you know. And when you set out a schedule, you know, if you can, stick to it. What type of things are in the schedule? This is Group A. What type of things are in the schedule? We're running out of time here, people. Yes, Stella.
Time to get up, time to go to bed, time for a rest, times to eat, times sessions for meditation, times to study, time to maybe go for a walk.
Yes, good. That's the type of things you want to put in. Because, you know, as Jenny says, it's not to beat yourself up with, but if you have a routine, if you have a structure, it is so helpful. And just take it as a discipline. Can I stick to this schedule? Oh, yeah, but maybe this will happen. No. Let's do for 2 days. Stick to the schedule. It won't kill you. You'll manage. See how it is. Thank you. So let's think now that you're preparing, Group B, you're preparing for 3 to 6 months retreat. who's going to be the spokesperson for group B? Fooling hen's teeth. Who was in group B? Oh, Ali, good. What did you decide, Ali?
Okay, well, we decided that we'd have to, first of all, think of financial situations, can we afford this? Are we healthy? You know, will we be able to sustain it? Then the practical implications to do with relatives, where we're going to do it, and probably for a very long retreat, you know, people talking about Land of Joy or Koh Phan or wherever, to be supported in that, and that really support would be absolutely crucial. Having a go-to teacher that you would, with like you and Lama Alan, you know, that you'd arrange that you would have a, you know, meeting once a week, once a fortnight, whatever it is, so that you would relay difficulties, having the wisdom to know when it is real difficulty, say if you're having the demons, or, you know, or when it's just, you know, a bit of an entanglement that you could work out for yourself. So, but basically, because it's such a long time, it's the financial, and if you've got ill relatives. I mean, I'm meant to be on retreat right now, but my partner had a quadruple bypass, so hence I'm not on my month's retreat, I'm on a week retreat, because, you know, I couldn't forsake him for my own retreat. That wouldn't be very nice. So many, many more practicalities. You may have to give up a job. You know, you may have to put your cat in a with a friend. There's just so, so many things. So that's, but others probably have something to add.
Thank you. Who would like to add to that? Yes, Alfredo.
Yes, just at the end, I didn't feel the time ended, but since food and eating is an important part that we cannot obviate, it reminded me of Venerable Gyatso when I did my Lambrin retreat in Koh Phan. He talked, I guess it was for a whole session on advice for retreat, and he used as an example his experience of a 3 months retreat. One of the most useful logistics for me, which I guess would work either if it is a 2 days retreat or a 6 months retreat, was that he said, scheduling. What he did was once a week, he took some time to make ready as much of the food he was going to eat during the week, only once, and then the different meals he had. He also scheduled how long it was going to take both to, for example, warm it up or eat it. But just that very, very scheduled.
Definitely food is important. Then different teachers will talk about different things when you're preparing for all of what you've said is more than real, exactly what you need. But on top of the list, they say, first of all, you make sure you're absolutely mentally right to do this, right? You have to be kind of on top of your game to do a retreat. Not for 2 days. I think you can be reasonable. As long as you're reasonable, 2 days is okay. When you go longer, you really need to be mentally kind of fit. You know, you're reasonable in your mind. But a supportive environment, basically, that's it. Really a supportive environment. Finding a place that maybe can provide food that you need. A place, and there's places around. But otherwise, what Alfredo says, you know, sort of batch cooking. I learned to cook what's called flask cooking, cooking in a flask, very quick, very easy. But if you have a supportive environment and they're around that will provide your food, how wonderful, you don't have to think about that. That you can borrow things like a cushion, something for your altar, perhaps even borrowing a rupa, a nice tanka, So if you choose somewhere like Land of Joy, or you go to a Jamyang Leeds, Jamyang London, someplace like that, very supportive, less for you to carry. So having a supportive environment. If it's not so much like that, then you want a place that really you're not disturbed by people. That's the main thing. Noise is the real killer for a longer retreat. So you're not going to be disturbed by people. And if you're out in the wilds of Wisconsin, then, you know, no carnivorous animals. Okay, you want a location that's pleasant. You really do. That becomes quite important. You don't have disruptive people around you. This is why centers are so important, to be so helpful to you. You don't want disruptive people around you. And sometimes choosing a place because on a map and then going there and find out it's the shooting season. You know what I mean? You just don't want that. That's happened. Lama Alm was telling me about a guy who found this place in the middle of nowhere in America. I believe there's quite a few of nowhere in America. Built the hut from scratch, got everything ready, had a separate bit where he did his cooking. He got it all set up. He scores in, middle of nowhere, sitting down, and within 5 minutes, people are shooting elk. It was the deer hunting season, and suddenly he's surrounded by carnage. It happens. So really a supportive, make sure the location is pleasant. It's not inhabited by people that will disrupt your mind. Making sure it's a well place. There's some places, you know, in India, I've known people go and do retreat, not Kopan, but some places, they're really very dirty. They're cheap, but they're dirty. You don't want any place that's going to make you ill. You don't want any place. Be as healthy as you can. If you want to do it with a few people, which is always, you know, always a good idea until you're used to doing retreat, make sure that they're good companions. Okay? You know what I mean, don't you? You don't want people there that within a few days you just want to be at each other's throat. So if you're going to do it with a group, you need to meet up a few times beforehand just to make sure you're all kind of compatible. Because on retreat, your mind is going to become quite refined. And as it becomes refined, sometimes an external thing that happens can actually irritate it quite easily. The people that you're with, make sure their ethical values are the same as yours. Some people's idea of doing a retreat is not the same as other people's idea of doing a retreat. So if you're going to do a group retreat, make sure their ethical values are the same as yours and that you work out a schedule that's pleasing to everybody. There are some people who don't like getting up early in the morning. There's some people who they're much better in the evening. As long as you know that, it won't be disruptive. But if you don't know that, it can be tricky. Mm-hmm. Most of all, when you go on a longer retreat, you need to have very few wants, very few desires. You take everything that you're going to need there. And once you're there, there's nothing you want. You have everything you want. You've got your practice, you've got your sadhanas, you've got your books that you need, you have a good environment, blah, blah, blah. There is nothing you want. You have enough soap. You have enough change of clothing. You've got a little screwdriver, so if your glasses go wrong, you can fix them. Even if you've got a spare pair, good idea. Get your teeth checked out beforehand. Have a checkup. Make sure you're as right as you could possibly be. Diarrhea will come. Constipation will come. Make sure you've got the remedies with you. Do you see what I'm saying here? Have few wants. Be able to deal with everything yourself. However, if you can't, then having a mentor of some sort in the area particularly is very helpful. When I did the retreat, I was allocated an individual by email. If I had a problem, I could contact this person, one of Lama Allen's top students. I didn't, because I'd done a lot of preparation, I really didn't need it. But because Lama Allen was in the area, he came to see me. And that was, of course, wonderful. If you've got someone that you can, that mentor that you got on well with, that would be wonderful. You don't really need to see this person every week. You really don't. But they need to be available. You need to know that I'm doing 6 months. In that 6 months, if I need you, can I email you or can I come and see you? So you agree that beforehand. A mind of contentment. You really need a mind of contentment. Now, of course, there'll be times when you don't feel very content. That's okay. But start it with a contented mind. This is where you want to be. This is what you want to do. In your retreat, having very few activities, certainly walking, very helpful. Reading, definitely. But apart from that, very few activities, very helpful. If you can do it, then very few activities. Most of all, pure ethical discipline. Be really ethical. Have your discipline, because remember how it works. Living ethically calms the mind. It's not just about being nice. Ethics calm the mind. If you have a calm mind, then the chances of you developing shamatha, much stronger. So you make sure your ethics are fine. And then, although there's a lot more, but most important, one of the other is try to work beforehand about reducing and eliminating compulsive thinking, compulsive rumination, this continual dialogue of this thought and that thought. This may be outside of meditation, but even so, try to really hit that on the head. Compulsive thoughts. I want this, I don't want that. And even if you make it nice, like you only want good things and you only don't want bad things, that's okay then. No. I've very few desires, very few compulsive thoughts. Notice if you're ruminating a lot, and take measures to stop that rumination. The supportive environment, having few desires, being content, having an ethical basis, and watching your thoughts. That's really what it's about. That's really what it's about. Dealing with all the social stuff before you go, it's amazing. I mean, even if you go away for a year, the amount of stuff I had to do just to make sure my house was still insured because it was an empty house. Suddenly my insurance went up. Do you understand? There's things that you don't think about. You don't want to keep paying for electricity and things like this. What about your car? What do you do with, so all of that. You all know this. You don't need anybody to tell you. You know this. And if you're planning it, that's extremely good. I'm going to finish this by just reminding you that the purpose of the shamatha meditation is really to develop or unveil stability and vividness of attention. This is what it's about. First of all, you refine your powers of attention. Then you start to use them to explore the mind, to purify the mind. All of this is a first-person perspective, so you have to start trusting yourself. The Buddha emphasized the sequence many times. Here's what it said. The Buddha said, what monks is sufficing condition of knowledge and a vision of things as they really are? And the Buddha said, it should be answered, concentration, samadhi. Kamala Shila said, because the mind is constantly moving like a river, because this mind isn't, the mind that we use now is not stationary, it has no foundation then of quiescence. The mind is not stable. It's not established in equipoise. And a mind that's not established in quiescence and equipoise is a mind that's incapable of knowing reality. How important is shamatha? All of that, plus Shantideva. He speaks for the entire Mahayana tradition. He says, realizing that one who is well endowed with insight by way of shamatha, eradicates mental afflictions. Therefore, one should first seek shamatha. So, any last questions? You've had enough. I understand. So maybe at this stage you give advice, but my advice is really just to continue to practice as and when. Read and reflect more. Take more teachings on shamatha. If you want to broaden your shamatha and you want to look at different structures, no problem. You always infuse your shamatha with bodhicitta. Always. There is nothing you can't achieve if you practice it long enough. And I really want to thank all those at Land of Joy who organized this, made this retreat possible. I can't. It just shows you the benefit of having centers. There are centers closing now. Centers that don't know are having difficulty really in maintaining themselves because of the COVID. And when centers do work, look what they can achieve. There's never been so many teachings now in all the centers. If you're not subscribed to all the FBMT websites and all the FBMT newspapers and newsletters, then do so. But there's more than that. There's more than that. It's a smorgasbord now of teachings. And I want a special heartfelt thank you to Faye for hosting this event. Really amazing. She's had to deal with so many difficulties. All I've had to do is to start back and she'll say, "Ben, Mary, I'll sort it." And I'm going, "Thank you so much." So a special thank you, Faye. It's been fantastic. And you've dealt with all the difficulties with calmness and skill. And I deeply appreciate that, deeply. But most of all my thanks go to every one of you just for attending, for turning up, for participating. And you've participated in a very generous way. You've all been, it's been very happy, very convivial, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And for my part, it's been an absolute delight. It's no hyperbole, it's been delightful. I've enjoyed every moment. To be able to share these wonderful teachings, what else would I do? It feels great. It feels great. Some people have asked me about my next teaching. I'm teaching in Beamsley the weekend of the 30th and 31st of this month. It's a weekend teaching on how to prepare for your own death. So fun all round. So please.
Mary, that is online and it's bookable through Jamyang Leeds.
So. Thank you. Yes, I always forget these things. Yes. It is bookable through Jamyang Leeds. So if you're interested, I'd love to see you there. But there's such a wide variety of things that are available for you now. How wonderful. How wonderful. So I just want to finish by saying keep well in these difficult times. And I really hope to see you all again soon. I really do. Yes?
Sorry, maybe you said it and I didn't get it, but is it going to be online, this
online? It's all online. Yeah. I'm not traveling this year at all. Thank you for reminding me. It's all online. Yeah. I don't want to make anybody sick. Can you imagine doing this job and then spreading COVID all over the place? No. Thank you, operator. So I know Jenny wants to have a few words, if she's around.
Jenny, you're muted, darling.
Sorry. Okay, I'll start again.
Okay.
Right, okay. Lovely. It's a bit feedback.
That's better.
Anyway, it's lovely to see you all. Hopefully there's not too much feedback on here. I'm glad you've all stayed the course and I think you've all enjoyed it by the looks of the smiles on your faces, which is great. So a couple of quick things. The audio recordings. So apart from today, the audio recordings, I think, are now on the resource page. If there are any problems, let me know. Hopefully I'll get the other audio recordings on tomorrow. They're not on the website, so you have to go through the link that you were sent in the email that we sent out earlier. So if you go through that link, you'll get the audio recordings and you can download them. I will attempt to put up the videos also, but I haven't quite got to that yet. I'm slightly concerned I make some huge mistake and the whole thing goes down. So I'll give that a shot soon. The second thing was that now that you're sort of all connected to each other and, you know, you've had the support of each other during this week and this practice, we were wondering, and Ben Mary was wondering, if you as a group would like to sort of get together and possibly form your own little support group. Now, the simplest way to do that would be, because we have, you know, data protection, all the rest of it, I can't just share emails with people. The simplest way to do that was if somebody was willing here and now to put their hand up to sort of organize the group, and then I can share that person's email with everyone. I'm waiting. Any takers?
Can they have some time to think about it? Or
yes, they could have some time to think about it. Yeah.
Carol's
put her hand up.
Carol's put her hand up, yeah.
Excellent. Okay, that's brilliant. So I don't need to go into the rest. What I will do is that I will send you Carol's email address, and then those of you, to everybody in the group, not just those who are here this afternoon, and then those of you who feel that this would be beneficial to you, then you get in touch with Carol directly and you can all set that up between yourselves. Okay. Sounds straightforward. Brilliant. Great. Thank you very much, Carol. So other than that, I guess that's just a big thank you from Land of Joy for obviously participating in this retreat, and just by the side, you know, I've listened to the odd bits of video audio and heard odd things and seen Ben Mary's response, which, you know, you've obviously, she's really enjoyed teaching you, and I think you've really enjoyed the retreat. So I'm really pleased about that. It's great that we can facilitate that when we can't have you here on site. And thank you also for your financial support. That's been really much appreciated. I'm sure Ben Mary also will much appreciate that as well.
All right. Okay.
So that's all from me, just a thank you, and we hope to see some of you back here at Land of Joy before too long, and others of you online also. Okay, and I'll hand you back to Ben Mary. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks, Jenny. It just shows you how wonderful it is just to have these centres that can actually do this. It's not an easy time for centres at the moment, not easy. So the support that you've given financially, and also, you know, just by participating, it's very appreciated. Very appreciated. Good. So, really important now that we dedicate strongly. Really important.
Just before we do that, sorry, Jenny speaking. Just before we do that, can we please all say how wonderful this retreat's been, Ben Mary? And it feels a little bit more appropriate to do that now before we dedicate. And just to thank you so much for all the teachings. And, you know, yes, I'm sure we've all got the book. And yes, I'm sure we can all read. But I think the way that you've distilled it and put it together has just been wonderful. And I think between, you know, the meditations and the discussions in the breakout rooms and the whole group, it's just been absolutely wonderful. So I just wanted to quickly get in with that before we move on to the dedication. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's just been a complete delight. Shamatha rules, okay. Thank you very much, Jenny. That's superb. It's always good to know. So just reflect, before we do the praise, just reflecting, you know, on the motivation that really drove us to be here at this retreat hosted by Land of Joy, our motivation. Just reflect on that again. Between then and now, so much learning taking place, so much practice, so much positive karma created. I know we've dedicated daily, but now let's just make this a super dedication. Really begin to direct that energy towards achieving the Mahayana motivation for the benefit of all sentient beings without exception. May I be able to do this? And when we do the prayers, just, you know, each line in those prayers, just make it strong. Make it strong dedication. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. Jan chog sem chog rim po she, ma ke pa dam ke gyur che, ke pa nyam pa me pa yam, mo ne gong du pel wa shu. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. For as long as space endures, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. None of this would be possible without the teachings and the support and the spiritual leadership of Lama Zopa Rinpoche and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. None of it. And so we'll do the short long life prayer for both Lama Zopa Rinpoche and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving and spreading Manjudas' victorious doctrines, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers, honouring the three jewels. Saviour of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you may know the Tibetan, so we'll sing the Tibetan and then say it in English. Dangri rawe korwe jingkam der pendang dewa malu jungwe ne chenre ziwang tensing yat so yi jape si te bardu tengur shi. In the land encircled by snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. O glorious Saviour Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Thank you very much. So I know that the Zoom window is going to be open for a few more minutes for people to say goodbye to each other and exchange whatever you need to exchange. Thank you again. So kind. Thank you.